Hi.
I'm an anthropologist, and I study streams of human behavior in order to understand what it is to be human. And I'm interested in those extremes in order to build adequate theories of human behavior. For example, universal theories based on evolution, like how human beings classify and do inference. Normative theories, like how they form political associations and combinations of the two, like what are the foundations or the space of all possible religions. More recently, what I've begun doing is studying people like suicide bombers and their supporters and political leaders working in intractable conflicts like Israel and Palestine and Iran and the United States. And I do field work with them from Borneo to Morocco and Europe. I trek with Mujahideen, I work with Qaeda and those types from time to time. And more lately, I've been involved in negotiations in the Middle East between the Hamas and the Israeli leadership and the Syrian government and others. And what I want to describe is certain aspects which I think modelers should take into account when trying to deal with things like security. So first I'm going to describe what I think are important aspects of intractable conflicts, and then I will talk a little bit about terrorism and how that relates to intractable conflicts. So what we've done lately, I work with lots of different people at different times. One of the people I work with in the intractable conflict side is a political scientist, Robert Axelrod, who sometimes accompanies me on these junkets to the Middle East and elsewhere. And on religion with behavioral economists like Joe Henrich. And what we try to do is design experiments, which I actually get Mujahideen to perform, and political leaders as well. You'd be surprised how they behave in experimental situations, just like undergraduates. So the first sort of set of data I'd like to present, and I didn't bring a PowerPoint here, but most of this stuff is published in places like Science or the Proceedings of the National Academy, is the idea of sacred values and sacred conflicts. And what we find is that in the most seemingly intractable conflicts, standard business-like negotiations just don't work. Now, most people who go into negotiations want to treat it as business-like negotiations and start off with the premise that negotiations involve give and take. Well, with sacred values, there is no such thing as give and take because it defines who you are. For example, sacred values differ from society to society, but one of our standard sacred values, of course, in our own society is our children. For example, we wouldn't usually give up our children for all the money in China, and the more people push you to give up your children for, say, whatever is fungible with children, the more you get angry and think they're sociopaths. Well, it's pretty much the same thing when people are asked to give up their sacred values. For example, the Taliban giving up their arms is about as improbable as getting the National Rifle Association to repeal the Second Amendment. And so what I try to do is show that these phenomena exist, and then I take them to places like the Senate and the White House, and I try to convince them that these are things that they should consider as well, and that carrots and sticks approaches can sometimes backfire. And what we find is that when we offer trade-offs, well, first we go to political leaders. We find out the range of trade-offs they're willing to allow or disallow, and then we test them in random samples among the populations, and then we go back to the leaders with our results. So one of the things we found in discussions with political leaders, for example, the Hamas and the Israeli leadership, is that they are unwilling to make certain kinds of trade-offs, period. For example, if you offer a peace deal, and by the way, if you offer a peace deal and you bring some credible witnesses with you, for example, people who've worked at the White House and taken to Damascus or something, and you say, would you accept a two-state solution and renounce the right of Palestinian refugees to come back to their homes? And of course, there's almost ceiling opposition to that. And then you show them data that say that reliable data from their own people, I mean, the people they approve, that less than 8% of the refugees would actually choose to go back. I mean, they're just interested in having their rights recognized. That still doesn't, of course, alter their position. Then if you get the other side to offer a significant material incentive, for example, we get representatives of the European Union to offer 100 million euros over the next 10 years to the Palestinian Authority if they would accept some such a compromise, and we find that among people who consider things like the right of return of refugees to be a sacred value, you find opposition to the deal goes up significantly. Violence goes up significantly. Support for suicide bombing goes up significantly. And this is independent of what political group you happen to be dealing with. We've done this with Israelis 4 days before they withdrew from Gaza. We found the same idea. In fact, Sharon said, well, I should have said they were Zionist heroes. I shouldn't have said that they were parasites on our body politic. We should have addressed their sacred values. But when the offer, the trade-off, is a purely symbolic gesture from the other side of no material value, and we make sure that it has no material value, we do follow-up studies, for example, an apology. What if the Israelis were simply to apologize for what happened in 1948, nothing more, and say they were partly responsible for the dislocation and dispossession of the refugees? We find that opposition to violence goes significantly up. That is, opposition to the deal goes significantly down, support for suicide bombing and violence goes significantly down. We've done this in many different venues, and we've tested this for thousands of people, randomly sampled between subjects designs, within subjects designs. Lately, we've been doing work in Iran. We've tested in 28 of 30 provinces Iran on the acquisition of a nuclear capability. Unfortunately, our first results were misrepresented in the press, where we found that acquiring a nuclear capability was a sacred value for at least 11% of the people. Well, that's closely identified with the ruling regime. That's enough. Of course, that's about the percentage that has ruled Syria for the last few decades. But the press reported it as Iranian nuke sacred. So we went back and we've tested now thousands of people, as I said, in different provinces, and we find that this is true for acquiring a nuclear energy capability, but not for acquiring nuclear weapons. However, in both cases, an added material incentive or disincentive to give up increases opposition to the deal 1 minute and increases support for acquiring a nuclear capability, even a nuclear weapon. Okay, I'll finish with this. We're also interested in what gets people who are devoted to a particular ideology to actually commit violence. And if you look at, for example, in the Muslim world, polls show about 100 million people support what happened in 9/11. Very few thousands actually get involved in violence. Less than 300 have been arrested in the United States, only 60 seriously, less than 3,000 in Europe. And we find the greatest predictor of who will commit violence and do things like suicide terrorism is who their friends are. And it's an almost random process. Okay, it's a completely social network process. 80% of the people who join the jihad do so through their friends. They do so in the diaspora. And there is no such thing really as recruitment from Al-Qaeda or anything like that, or cells or anything like that. It's mostly a grassroots process of young people joining up with one another. One last comment as I walk off the stage. The idea of a clash of civilizations is woefully misleading. It's actually a crash of civilizations as traditional territorial cultures decompose, and these young people are flailing about in search of a social identity. And the idea, especially in this sort of global media awakening, of fighting the most powerful army in the world, anyone can do it at any time, anywhere, is tremendously empowering and thrilling for young people and gives meaning in life, and the idea that happiness is martyrdom, and yes, we can, are competing now for the allegiance of these young people, and we haven't begun to ask them to steer this one way or the other.
Okay, so I'm going to
just talk for a few minutes about a specific aspect of judging risks of various kinds, which goes into many risk management processes, namely estimating probabilities and arguing that people can actually be quite good at this, given the right feedback. First, I thought I'd just share a photograph I took yesterday on my way here. I stopped at the gas station and saw a poster set up by the British police, which for me demonstrates just the level of sophistication of the British police force, because this works on so many levels. I'm still thinking about it. Anyway, so together with my co-worker and co-investigator Benjamin Jacobus, who's sitting over there, we've set up an online calibration test that we call Projection Point. This is a snapshot of the URL and of the homepage, rather. And this is a zooming in on what some of the questions look like in the calibration test. You're asked to, you're given 50 statements that can be true or false, and you're asked to say how likely you think it is that each one is true. You see, I've answered the first question there already. It's not very clear, but I've indicated that I think it's a 90% chance that that's true. And then once I've clicked on it, it indicates that whether or not it's true or not. I haven't answered the second statement. When we're doing this, there's a relationship between how certain I am and the estimate I put on it. If I put 0% or 100%, both of those indicate that I am maximally certain of the answer. If I put 100%, I'm certain that it's true. If I put 0%, I'm certain it's false. If I put 50%, I'm maximally uncertain. But the kind of stuff that we're interested in is on the slopes, where we're not entirely certain, not entirely uncertain, but we've got a hunch that tips us in one direction or another. So we think it's probably true or probably not true, but we're not entirely sure. So we use one of the intermediate values, 10, 20, 30, 40, or 60, 70, 80, 90. So what we do then, once we've got the answers for 50 questions, we calculate how many times someone used, say, the 10% category, and we see how many of those times the statement was actually true. And we plot that point on the graph with the prediction, with the categories along the bottom, and the frequency with which they were true up the side. So we get a graph something like this. If we were perfectly calibrated, our calibration curve would fit exactly on the identity line. That would mean that, for example, of all the times that we said something had a 10% chance of being true, of all the times we said that, 10% were actually true, and so on. Of course, not many people are perfectly calibrated, and so their curve will differ from the identity line. And what in this example, point A means that of all the times that someone used the 10% category, more than 30% of those statements turned out to be true, so they were overconfident in that direction. They were also overconfident in the other direction as well. And this is a fairly typical kind of broad pattern for a calibration curve, because and then you can see that of all the times they thought it was 70% true, only about 30% of them were actually true. Now, some people can be really good at this. Here's a graph of US weather forecasters, and you can see that this is the predicted probability of rainfall on the following day. And this shows you that their estimates lie almost perfectly on the identity line, so their calibration is superb. And these are US weather forecasters. This doesn't happen with Irish weather forecasters or British weather forecasters. It's not just because the weather is inherently more unpredictable in Ireland. In fact, it's probably more predictable because it's just rain every day. But in fact, US weather forecasters are required to express their estimates in numerical terms. So they will say, not just, oh, it's likely to rain tomorrow, but there's a 60% chance of rain. And it's because of this, this has been going on since the 1960s, and their calibrations got better and better because of that. So it is possible to do very well at this kind of task, despite the kind of general view that comes across from a cursory reading of the heuristics and biases literature, which would suggest that, you know, because people are always inherently systematically biased and are bad at this. That's not always true. If you get the right feedback, you can be very good at this. If you don't get the right feedback, you can be very bad. So this is, I work in the School of Medicine, and this is why I got interested in this, because medics are incredibly badly calibrated. This was a study with over 1,000, about 20 doctors, looking at 1,000 real patients. They were asked to say what probability did they have
a kind of pulmonary disorder. I can't remember which one it was. But then they, for each patient, then they took radiography of the chest area, and so they got an objective indicator. They were able to plot the calibration. As you can see, if these doctors said you had a 5% chance of having this disorder, it was probably about right, 5%. But if they said you had a 90% chance of having this disorder, in fact, your chance was still only just over 10%. So they're way overconfident. And we found all different kinds of calibration curves. You know, we had a talk this morning that showed different patterns. We find, you know, all of these patterns coming up in the data. It's not just people talk, say that it, often in the literature you get the idea that there's one kind of basic pattern, but you can have all of these four major types of pattern. Some are more common than others. A is probably the most common basic type. And I kind of make sense of this by assuming that there are opposing forces sort of pulling you up or down the various slopes. In particular, there's something that psychologists call the need for closure. And I think in graph A, which refers that if you've got a calibration curve that looks a bit like that, it's because this need for closure is sort of systematically pulling you towards one end. If you should be saying 40, you're sort of pulled up the slope to about 30. If you should be saying 60, you're pulled up the slope to about 70, because you kind of feel some need for certainty. This need for certainty could be in one particular direction, like B or C, or you could have a need to avoid closure, right? If you just want to be avoided, so that sometimes it can work in the other direction, as in D here, which gives you a graph like this one. Okay, so the history of calibration testing. Basically, it was very popular in the 1960s and 70s. People did a lot of specific testing of subgroups, such as the graphs I showed you come from that period, medics, weather forecasters, and so on. All these, they did very small samples because they had to do these tests with pen and paper. Is one of these sort of problem, you know, science has fads and fashions like everything else. It fell out of fashion in the 1980s and 90s, so which is good for us because it means that, you know, there's sort of rich pickings to be mined here. And now we can get a lot more data because we can use online tests to gather our data that weren't available to the researchers then. And so we've got this online, we've got 33,000 visitors now have done our tests. Well, we've got more visitors than that, but we've got over 33,000 test results so far since January. This was a graph we took from Google Analytics in February, which showed you can see a peak around sort of January, where it points up to about 2,500 hits in that day. That was when we had the combined forces of all the Irish media covering our website, the TV, the newspapers, we went on radio stations, everything. We got 2,500 hits. You can see in early February, February the 4th, we get almost 10,000 hits in one day. That's because we got covered on one blog. But it was just the right blog, okay? It was Pharyngula. And when you get covered on that blog, it just shows you the power of social media these days. You know, the old-fashioned media were completely wiped out by one blog entry. So we're also interested in not just the shape of the calibration test book, to get some very tractable data, we can just put a single number on this calibration. We call it RQ, for, you know, like EQ or IQ. We just basically calculate the area between the calibration curve and the identity line and build a number from that between 0 and 100, which is inversely proportional to the size of that area. And that allows us to sort of gather some population data. And this is based on about 10,000 test results. And we just constructed these categories so that we could get a kind of a graph that looks a bit like that, and then we can tell people, give some people their feedback. Well, some of our initial findings, we found that paranormal beliefs, we found there's a significant difference. We asked people to fill out some questions about this. We found that the calibration is significantly higher in those who do not believe in the paranormal. We've also found some interesting sex difference. This is what this graph refers to. The red line here is men and the blue line is women, and we found that education, as you can see, improved. That along the bottom we've got education level seems to improve risk calibration in men but not in women for some reason. The further research we're going on to now, we've also got a prediction game going on the website in which the statements refer not to current facts or general knowledge but to future events. So people are asked to estimate the chances, for example, that US combat troops will be sent to Yemen. We want to see whether the ability to make good predictions correlates with the RQ number that we get from the factual knowledge test. And we're also now developing the possibility to enable user-specified prediction games where users can sign up for admin accounts to create domain-specific predictions. So, for example, the head of a prop desk in a bank could create his own subdomain to ask each trader to estimate the probability for each trade that it will make a profit. A police chief could ask each officer to estimate the chance that each arrest will lead to a conviction. The head of airport security unit could ask each TSA airport screener to estimate the probability that each search will find a prescribed item. And you could actually then see the individual differences in calibration for those people. And that's it.
Good afternoon. My name is Raghav Lavsted. I'm a professor of risk management at King's College in the Department of Geography. So I feel, I must say, I'm a bit of an imposter here. I'm not a computer scientist, don't work in security, I'm not even a psychologist. And furthermore, I had a PowerPoint, but basically I didn't know it's a 5-10 minute presentation, so what? You're not going to get a PowerPoint either. So I wrote my presentation, but don't worry, I'm not going to read off my presentation. So what can I contribute to this meeting? I thought I could share with you some ideas on the changing nature of risk communication and management policy and situations, both in Europe and North America, based on observations and discussions with a number of senior regulators, both in the US at FDA and EPA, as well as in the Office of Management and Budget in the US, as well as our colleagues at HM Treasury in the UK, and folks in the European Commission, as well as in my native country, Sweden. And basically, then we can see if these ideas are relevant to your field. I'm going to discuss that and bring up the discussion. Firstly, there are a number of discussions basically noting that due to a whole series of ideas, and primarily a series of regulatory scandals, such as mad cow disease in the UK, tainted blood in France, dioxin scare in Belgium, and as well, of course, you know, Vioxx, COX-2 issues, Avandia in the US, there are now publics and stakeholders' trust in regulators and politicians are decreasing. As a result, policymakers and regulators are playing catch up. They're saying, we need to increase the public trust. We want this public trust back. So what do these folks do? I'm going to share with you a couple of ideas. I know we're very brief on time. One is basically the whole issue is that we should have more public deliberation. We should have the public participating in making policy. The work from Wiedemann and Weber, for example, shows by including the public in decision-making processes, this will make the process fairer. And as a result, basically, the public trust can then increase. There are many examples from that in regard to siting of waste incinerators throughout Europe, as well, of course, basically ensuring that Swedish boat owners comply to basically the strict anti-fouling chemical regulations. However, there's a problem with this. Not all of us want to participate in the policy-making process. I did a study some 10 years ago now in Baden-Württemberg in the North Black Forest with regard to basically citing a waste incinerator. We basically wanted to get a group of public together to help decide where to best place this waste incinerator to ensure that the public would be happy with this, basically, and ensure there'd be no massive protests. What happened here was that the study leader asked 5,440 Germans from North Black Forest to participate in making the decision, to participate once a week on a Wednesday for 2 hours and so in for 6 months and get 700 Deutschmark. Guess how many people participated out of 5,440? How many of the people said yes?
Three.
Very good. 191. Okay, out of 191, what do these people have in common? There are two things in common. A, they were opposed to incinerators. So they didn't want any kind of incinerator. They were anti-incinerators. And B, they had time on their hands. So basically, they were unemployed, they were students, they were basically housemen or housewives, or they were pensioners. Not the typical Baden-Württembergian population, as one of our colleagues actually near Stuttgart knows. They are hard workers, and they're not unemployed. And they also better conservative. Another important issue was the whole issue of tougher regulation. Research, once again, from Wren et al., and also basically agreed to by regulators, shows that there is a direct correlation between tough regulation and high levels of public trust. If you're tough, basically, the public feel that you have their best interest at heart. Furthermore, of course, a weak regulator is seen as what? As seen to be captured by industry. They are in industry's back pockets, basically, and that's basically bad news. What, of course, then happens once we have scandals and so on and so forth is that in many cases, regulators want to recapture public trust. They say, basically, now we've got to go out there, let's get forward a real tough regulation and get that trust back. The issue here, and I warn, and I want to talk to the regulators about this, we need to ensure that the regulations they're putting forward are based on best available science. and based on past history, this is not always the case, particularly when you have a knee-jerk reaction. For example, the infamous UK beef on the bone ban that we had that was put in place following the mad cow crisis, which caused basically a bunch of laughter with Prince Charles saying, basically, I'm going to leave my bone and my beef when the Sunday roast is totally fine. Furthermore, and this is a topic that may interest you the most. Is this interesting, by the way? Is this okay? You guys like it? You guys are being very polite to me. You're being very polite. It's basically transparency, okay? It is discussed in the Obama administration. We discovered we'd be more open and transparent than ever before. It basically seems transparency is no bad. It is only has to be good. And the issue here, of course, basically is that, is this always the case? Is it always good to basically web stream decisions at the Nuclear Regulatory Council or the UK Food Standards Agency? Or basically, should we continue dumping data on the internet? See, I am not sure. Firstly, basically, one of your Cambridge colleagues, and there are a number of Cambridge colleagues here, Honora Neal, argues very persuasively that transparency empowers the stakeholders that are hostile to your cause. For example, the clinical trial data put online by pharma companies did not necessarily help patients and doctors. One pharma company told me, for example, that 95% of the traffic on their clinical trial data set was represented by two groups. They were? Very good. They were the U.S. trial lawyers and basically competitors. That's it. Not concerned patients and not doctors. Furthermore, the indiscriminate dumping of data on the internet leads to public confusion. In one quantitative study with regard to posting of adverse event signal reports, these are reports where you see there's a possible signal of a drug that may have an effect, but it hasn't been proven. It's just a possible one. It's a signal, it's not been proven. And FDA now, following the September 2000 FDA passage, have to basically, by law, put these quarterly postings on the internet. And what happened here basically was, in our study, we interviewed 1,000 Americans. It was an internet study, so it wasn't completely perfect, as our colleague from Exeter had to say, and 433 doctors. We found that overall, the public welcomed early information. Of course, they don't want to be ignorant, right? We'll welcome, I'm almost done. We welcome early information. This is really a very, very good thing. Did the doctors want early information on the internet? Thank you. No, not at all. Because they were concerned about worried patients calling them, basically asking, what the hell is going on here? What should I take this medicine or not? However, once we did a scenario, we basically walked these patients through a signal posting internet, to find out, do they actually understand this posting? And would they stop taking the drugs? What we found then was that 61% of these patients said either A, will stop taking the drug, or I may consider stop taking the drug, which goes against all the advice provided by the FDA. So, in conclusion, because I want to be on time here, I'm not looking at here, A, basically, there is trust in regulators and politicians have in many countries decreased over time, A. B, there's been a number of measures put forward by the regulators and politicians to regain this public trust. And C, in my view, these measures should now be evaluated, particularly the case with the U.S. and basically the FDA's transparency initiative. Thank you very much.
Bill, you will not get the 90 seconds extra. Unless you really...
Cancel.
Okay. First of all, we've heard a lot of terrific presentations about perceived risk, the role of emotion, perhaps some of the implications economically and so forth. So let me just say something before I start the presentation. This morning, Paul Slovic and I and a team of economists just submitted, before walking over here, a paper we just concluded on looking at the economic impact of perceived risk and emotion for a dirty bomb attack on the city of Los Angeles, patterned after the Department of Homeland Security scenario. Less than 200 people die, no property damage. 30 days later, the mayor declares the city safe and able to go back to normal activities. We built an economic model in the entire city of Los Angeles. And we did a nationwide survey, so forth, worked with the city of Los Angeles emergency response teams. And our estimates now, the economic impact of that event, is over $10 billion. And this is why dirty bomb attacks were often called mass disruption, with huge potential economic impacts. We found that almost all the costs were not due to loss of life or property, but rather to, in the first 30 days, business interruption, shutting down the city. And this was in this event, it was only a 6 by 6 block area of the financial district, just the downtown area. And the most of it comes not from the event itself, but our reaction to the event. For every $10, or for every $1 we might spend to help business owners help compensate for loss of life and what little property damage there is, you spend $10 dealing with perceived risk and emotional response. And so a lot of this work is very, very important. I was thrilled to hear some of the presentations. Anyway, on that, I will make mention that Paul Slovig and I's work is beginning to shift in a major way over the last 2 years, where we do not do experimentation in the lab anymore one time. What we try to do is study real events and over time to look at how people change. And so I will talk very briefly about some stuff that we've done. And so we looked at the Christmas Day terrorist attempt. In fact, I queried Bruce for his help, submit some questions a couple days afterward. These dates are wrong. I don't know why I was off by a year here. That should be December 31, 2009, and the rest should be 2010. I don't know what I was thinking. But we have four waves of data collected on a nationwide panel. So December, January, February, and most recently May. And I'll talk about three crises, the terrorist attempt on Christmas Day, the Haiti earthquake, and the Times Square attempt. The scales that I'll be talking about, like perceived likelihood of a terrorist event or being harmed, 1 to 4 for being very likely, how fearful are you or how sad are you, 4 is very fearful or very sad. You're postponing your activities, that is to fly in an airline, on a scale of 1 to 4 for being very likely to postpone, and that pulls out the people who we queried that said, we don't have any plans to fly anyway. So this is based on the people that really did have plans and will now postpone and increase risk, and then we'll Bruce contributed some questions about the TSA. And here's the way it looks. Up here we have, this is the, well, what are the odds of terrorist attack taking place in the next 12 months in the U.S. on a scale of 1 to 4, and a couple days after the terrorist attempt, we're up at the mean response is 2.92, and what we're really interested in is the decay rate. Not the actual level, but the decay rate. We see that there's a decay rate here over time. I mean, arguably the odds of a terrorist attack didn't change, but people's perceptions decay over time. And then we see, why do you think this blipped up here? We see this decay rate, now it's high. What's going on? What happened between those two dates? Times Square. And this is, so now here we are. Now, interestingly enough, we were criticized, well, not we, but the public was criticized in being irrational, that they thought it was likely that a terrorist attack would occur, again, in the United States in 12 months. And many folks, myself included, thought this was irrational. But in fact, the public was right. You know, that's the interesting thing about it. And then this is the perception that you'd be harmed if you were on an airplane, and it's noticeably less here. We see this consistently, by the way, when people have a perception of their own personal risk, it's lower than the perceived risk to other people. Fear begins to decay. Your postponing doesn't decay until about 2 months out. This is quite consistent. Our behaviors tend to show a certain inertia. And we've seen this consistently. Is air travel more risky? We see a decay here. Here is, would you be We're looking at the emotion sadness. Now, I picked sadness as opposed to anger or fear because there's a commonality here. What would you say is the predominant emotion with terrorism? Fear, what else?
Anger.
And anger is actually the bigger one. But fear is up there. Sadness comes third. The financial crisis, likewise, anger was the big emotion, followed by fear and worrying, but there is sadness. Earthquake, not surprisingly, it's sadness when we asked. You know, there's not a lot of room for anger or fear. Notice here that this decays.
This was asking Americans about the earthquake.
This is what? Yes, right. This is all, thank you. This is all nationwide. These are Americans. But we wanted to know what their perceptions, because often what we find, Paul and I, is there's a marked difference in how people respond to intentional acts like terrorism or negligent acts like industrial accidents. Well, we're seeing this played out with BP right now versus natural disasters. And here, notice that the decay rate is actually steeper here, just as we would have predicted. That even though, what was the loss of life here? It was 270,000 people, something like this. And yet, we see that there's a steeper rate of decay. And this is one of the problems with getting people, and when we quarantined people, by the way, in California, would it change their behavior in terms of earthquake preparedness? There was very little change. It's tough to get people to really think about natural disasters, even though for where I live in San Diego, the risk of an earthquake, you know, where are the real risks? Well, it's earthquake and things like this. It's not so much terrorism. Bruce helped us with. In fact, there's an interesting story that as I was formulating these kind of questions, thinking about this, I was about to email Bruce I was in the midst of emailing Bruce about could he contribute to questions. My wife said, you ought to come out and listen to Rachel Maddow. There's an interesting guy here that you might be interested in. And it turned out it was Bruce, here as I am, right, you know, this incredible coincidence. We had T-bowed his feature on Rachel, and there it was. But you'll notice that here are the perceptions of the likelihood of preventing an attack. If you restrict liquids and x-rays, people are not especially confident that it prevents things. We benchmark it against securing the cockpit door that most security experts really do believe. And even here you see that 17% don't think that does anything, which is probably mistaken. And so we're dealing with a lot of cynicism with regards to the TSA. Here's the perceptions of motives. To make travel safer. Well, only here do we see that greater than half the people we queried think that the motive is to make people safer. Most of them think it's either, I think you call this security theater right here, or to make themselves look better. And so this is something that there's a communication problem. And incidentally, this was collected a few days after Christmas. But as we queried people over time, this actually degraded, even got worse. Something was going on. Okay, and I'm going to skip right to, this is the Times Square incident. And here I'll just draw your attention that almost 20% of people intend to postpone their travel to a major city as a result of the Times Square, even though it was remarkably well handled. And so this is a challenge and contributes to economic impacts. Here's our study of the financial crisis over an entire year. Perceived risk, emotional reaction. And we're just about to publish this study as well. We tracked a nationwide panel starting in September 29. These dates actually are real. Notice here that the tremendous dip, and we have two explanations for this. This is quite consistent with simulation models that Paul and I built that predict that the greatest the decline in perceived risk and fear will occur almost immediately after the event, and then it will plateau out. But what do you suppose is going on here? Look at these dates, look at this as an alternative explanation. What happened between September 29, 2008 and November 5th? Yes, absolutely. And this is the Obama effect. He ran on a campaign of change and hope and so forth. So we don't know, we're still trying to tease out what's really going on. This may be a confirmation, a very viable corroboration of Paul and I's work, or there may be an alternative, the Obama effect. And that's it. I'm done.
How long is it? It's 10 minutes.
Okay.
Is this the pointy red thing?
Yeah, just stare at it too hard.
Bill?
Bill?
Is there any chance I can follow your pointy red thing?
Oh, yeah, sure, of course.
Sorry, I thought...
Give him the death ray.
Yeah, red button.
Good. All right, thanks for having me. I wrote this a couple of weeks ago, and I literally came from Glastonbury Festival site yesterday afternoon to here, so I'm hoping it's current and concise enough. So I'll try and be quick. Quick acknowledgements. John Geary and Steve Reicher and Cliff Stott have been very helpful with this work. What I'm going to talk to you today about is emergency crowd behaviour. I've called it Far From the Madding Crowd, because I'm going to recap on material that we've looked at, but I also want to explore directions that we want to take it in, how we want to redevelop the theories. We have a social psychological perspective on security. What we're interested in is looking at how do groups of people respond to threats, how do groups of people behave in emergencies. And that's what I focus on collective rather than individual responses. The response of the mass. What happens in a mass crowd, in a mass emergency? What do people do? It's inspired by social identity and self-categorisation approaches, and we take a very much less pessimistic view of human nature than many social psychologists do. I often find that lay perceptions of social psychology come up against the horrendous experiments that would never be approved by ethics committees now, such as the Milgram obedience experiments and the Zimbardo Stanford prison experiment. And the basic premise beneath that is, deep down, if you scratch beneath the surface, people are selfish beings who have a capacity for doing evil, and therefore we need structures and things to prevent people from doing that. We don't share that perspective in that we have a more optimistic view, and often people's behaviour cannot be dependent by the social context. So yes, people can behave in bad antisocial ways, but given the right social context as well, people can behave in good ways to each other. And perhaps we have a moral duty to look at those situations where people do behave nicely to each other and looking at how we can encourage those situations rather than throwing our hands up in the air and saying deep down human beings are just bad. Okay, so who started it all off then? Gustave Le Bon was the first sort of most well-known French social psychologist who looked at the behaviour of the crowd. As was mentioned earlier by Dylan, he was a French aristocrat, a gentleman observer who observed crowds during the Paris Commune. He clearly had a view that was very anti the crowd. He was a gentleman observer, and his book, The Crowd, A Study of the Popular Mind, unfortunately, though, is still very influential today among certain sectors of society that deal in emergency management. So we're finding that we're constantly coming up against this view. His view was that crowds are inherently irrational. There's something about being in a crowd, that if you join a crowd, you lose your individuality to a collective mob mentality. You descend a few rungs on the ladder of civilization, was one of his favourite quotes. And therefore, crowds are either an actual or a potential threat. They're either a threat because they're there, rioting, looting, raping and pillaging in front of you, or also because they have the potential. Some spark could set the crowd off, and therefore they could go like wildfire. So you have to treat them, even if they're not doing anything badly, you have to prepare for the fact that they might do something badly. And we're heavily critical of that because, unfortunately, this becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. It sounds quite commonsensical. But if you treat crowds badly, funnily enough, they might behave badly as well. So we would argue if you treat them well, they're more likely to behave well. So this model is heavily critiqued. But as I said, some organisations are still influenced by his work today. Although, thankfully, I believe that things are changing in this area when the social identity model is becoming more prevalent in those who are using crowd emergency management. Okay, so what did he suggest then? The panic model wasn't explicitly suggested by Le Bon. He looked at disorder. But the panic model has developed, and it clearly draws upon Le Bonian theories. And it's very strongly influenced by the irrationalist tradition. It has four main premises. First of all, when you're faced by a threat, you become fearful. And this emotion, the fear you have when you have a threat to your life, an emergency, this overwhelms your reason. You can't make rational choices. So therefore, your collective identity breaks down. You don't care about anyone else. All you care about is number one, and you will then behave selfishly to save yourself. You will push, you will trample, and the classic Le Bonian idea of woe is contagion. that these behaviors spread like wildfire through a crowd. If someone starts pushing and trampling and screaming, everyone else will join in because they'll go, oh my God, if I don't do this, I'm going to die. Now, this has clear implications for emergency planning because what it does is it assumes that rather than a safety management issue, emergency planning should be a public order issue. And we would say that that's very problematic for emergency planning. So, now this is an artist's impression of what happened in a fire in the Iroquois Theatre in Chicago at the turn of the last century. About 400 people died. This is obviously a very hypothetical thing. It's before the days of photographs. But you have classic elements of panic going on here. You have a baby, looks like it's been thrown above someone's head, people chucking up their top hats, someone's got their leg in the air, verbal gesticulations, everyone's dying, and that's the assumption that this happens. Now, what actually is reality in emergency is that this is very rarely the case. People are guided by social norms. People will let other people go first, and the thing that often causes fatalities and fires is not that people panic, it's because people don't act with enough sense of urgency. And then it becomes too late, because particularly with the spread of fires. And so, ironically then, it might be because they don't panic rather than that they do panic that explains a lot of the fatalities. Okay, so the social identity model, which is where I come from, would argue in direct opposition then that disasters actually create a shared common identity. Your collective identity, far from decreasing, could actually increase. And this could result in you engaging in orderly altruistic behaviour amongst people who may be complete strangers. Because in most mass emergencies and crowds, the majority of the people in a crowd, you're unlikely to know. So you could be with a bunch of complete strangers. So this common identity strengthens in the face of a threat. Because the stronger the threat is, if there is a threat to your life, then the stronger the need is for you to act cooperatively together with each other. Now, this is supported not only by psychologists, but also by sociologists who've looked at many disasters over the last 50, 60 years. The Hiroshima bombings, 9/11, the 7/7 emergencies. There's lots of evidence to support this model. And it argues that spontaneous resilience might actually develop. People can be much more resilient in emergencies. And this is the norm. This is not the exception. We don't make any claims that everyone behaves like heroes in crowds, but when people do become fearful and perhaps even behave selfishly, it's a problem that's isolated within individuals. It's not a group problem, it's an individual problem. Now, this idea of resilience is not new, but the idea of vulnerability and irrationality during and post-emergencies, unfortunately, is still deeply ingrained, not only in popular culture, but to a lesser extent in some emergency planning. Although, as I said, thankfully, this has changed a lot recently. Something, though, that I'd like to look at, and I'm conscious here I don't want people to think I'm reverting back to Le Bonian ideas, is something that we've become aware of in our research, is that the social identity model, which rightly critiques the irrational crowd, may unfortunately neglect the role of emotion in mass behaviour, the role of, say, fear, anger, happiness. It's quite a cold, logical model, which is good, but then it also neglects that possibility. And recent evidence that me and my colleagues have gathered has suggested that during crowd flight, there may be some very brief elements of panic-type behaviour. And the particular thing I'm looking at the moment is what happens when a crowd is charged by riot police. Now, obviously, and this might sound a bit commonsensical, crowds scatter. If you're charged by big men and, to a lesser degree, women running at you, either on horseback or with large sticks, you want to get out of the way. That's not a particularly obvious thing. But there appears to be a very brief moment where people scatter, maybe for a few seconds. What we found, though, is though rather than dispersing, which is what the idea of a public order tactic is, to scatter a crowd, to make them disperse and to end the demonstration. 1 minute. Right, I better move because I want to show you a video. So the theory then is, do the fear that people experience momentarily overcome their socialised responses, or do they remain aware of their own sociality within this? So I will show you this video. It's very quick. It's basically, it was the G20 protests outside the Bank of England in the City of London last year. Oh, all right. Well, I'll talk about it and then go on to the next one. Basically, you see a surge, you see the crowd run away, but then almost instantly they go back in, more angry and more militant. And we could say this public order tactic is actually counterproductive, because what it does is it unites a previously disparate crowd who are then angry that they've been charged and become more militant and less likely to disperse. So indiscriminate public order tactics, we would say, are actually counterproductive. Another area we want to look at is joy, the joy of collectivity. Much is made of the negative physical aspects of crowding, but why do people choose to be with others, and sometimes in large crowds? This common identity means that we have a shared experience, and what we're looking at is football matches, religious festivals, and am I up for time? One more. So, what we're looking at now, as again, just come from Glastonbury Festival, and things that we're looking at is there's some very good infrastructure there, looking at how resilience is actually built in, not only into the planning, but also the crowd. And it's something we want to look at, is the crowd might actually be a resource for planning. For in emergencies, the services can draw upon the aspects of the natural resilience of the crowd to help them in emergencies. And that's something that we'd like to collaborate with festival organisers to look at, that crowd safety and prevention of disaster often happens not in spite of the crowd, but because of it. The crowd can actually help save disaster. And I've certainly worked at least one event, a mass party on Brighton Beach, where if it wasn't for the crowd, we probably would have had a mass catastrophe on our hands because the infrastructure broke down. But the nature of the crowd meant that there was a lot more cooperation and much less aggression than one would expect because of the nature of the festival. It was a music-free festival. Okay, so final summary then. The crowd's a very much maligned and misunderstood creature. There are problems that exist in emergencies, we're not denying that, but it's usually to do a lack of communication or physical pressures rather than the pathological nature of the crowds. You can trust crowds more and you can give them more information. Any anti-normative behaviours are located with individuals and not the group, and crowds are very good at self-policing. But we do need to know more about joy and fear. Let's remember this. Thank you.
Right, I always get the last grave shift sort of spot. My name is Frank Ferreri. I'm a sociologist. And over the last 10 years, most of my work has been focused around the problem of fear and also risk. And at the moment what I'm doing is I'm working on a book for Cambridge University Press, which looks at the different fear and risk cultures that exist historically. And what I'm trying to do is to look at human experience from ancient Athens onwards to today. If you take ancient Athens, 600-700 BC, you find that after the Battle of Salamis, the whole of Athens just gets up and they move, and they're not worried about losing their land, they're not worried about leaving their house to the invading Persian army. They are the real risk takers. They really take risks very robustly, very seriously. You take the United States, 21st century, and it's the very opposite, a nation of I'm peeing in my pants the minute there is any kind of danger. And one of the things that I'm particularly interested in is the way that precautionary culture has become a very distinct accomplishment. I think cultures of risk are defined by four characteristics in a historical sense. It's about meaning, it's about your ideas about uncertainty, it's about your ideas about knowledge, and also finally about agency, how you make and what you think of agency. And one of the things that I'm looking at the moment in terms of culture of risks is the performance of risk, how risk is performed. Because increasingly, both precautionary culture and risk is performed and ritualized and dramatized in a number of different ways. Because we do live in a world where the idea of precaution becoming institutionalized is fueled by the idea of what I've called elsewhere worst case thinking, where every time anything happens, we always assume the worst case. So if you take the BP oil spill, an interesting article in Newsweek online, the oil spill's worst case scenario. And the oil spill's worst case scenario is simply a blogger who happened to dream up the worst thing that could happen. And once he's done that, then you have a whole series of other people entering into the discussion, fantasizing about even worse cases that this person hasn't thought about. And Newsweek tells us, well, this might not occur, but just in case it does, we should begin to plan for this contingency. And that's what worst case thinking does. And what it does, and this is what I argue in my work, is that increasingly it kind of transforms risk into a fantasy. Risk becomes increasingly fantastical, rather than anything that's kind of related to what used to be probabilities of any sort, and acquires a cultural dynamic of its own. One of the things I've been collecting are the rituals of risk and of fear, and there are millions of them. In Britain, We have this thing that we use all the time. If there's ever any scary TV program, I don't know about the United States, but in England what we do is at the end of the program we've got a voiceover and it says, if you've been seriously affected by this program, do you have that in the United States?
No. You know, so,
well, if you've been seriously affected by this program, and here's a helpline.
It's the beginning of the program.
But the interesting thing is that, that this is done for a very dramatic effect. Why tell people, you know, this at the very end of the program, except for the fact that you want to scare people even more? Right? The very fact, because if you haven't been affected by this program, there's something wrong with you. I mean, that's the message that is subliminally communicated to you. And there are numerous examples of the way that risk is performed and the way that we incite people to do this. I think the most interesting example that was completely misunderstood by the press happened very recently at the House of Energy and Environmental Subcommittee hearing in the United States, where they had the chief executives of the five big oil companies all coming and accounting for themselves. And one of the things that became very clear was that, you know, when they looked at the emergency response plan of these organizations, it became very, very clear that the same guy was all five of them. Right? And this is something I've been arguing, because I've noticed one of my PhD students has looked at risk fantasy documents in England, and we noticed that mission statements, companies' business ethics statements, risk impact statements, all have the same language. You get the impression that there's this one schmuck somewhere inside London, and he's making a living, a fortune, out of writing all these documents for every kind of company. But anyways, here we have proof, because the same Texas top contractor wrote all five of these documents. But what's even more interesting, if you read it, it was very clear that nobody had read the documents until that congressional subcommittee meeting. Because as you know, the documents refer to the importance of dealing with the risk of injury to walruses. There aren't very many walruses in around Mexico or Louisiana.
Right, see the
problem? Well, that's right. I mean, that's worst case thinking at its best, you know. So, but also sea lions, seals, and all these animals. And a lot of people thought this was very, very interesting. But you know, what a dishonest company. But what they forgot was that BP and all these other companies were actually pressurized into writing these kinds of documents. It isn't just simply deception. It's also self-deception, because they know that if you're meant to be an environmentally responsible petroleum company, then you do have to demonstrate that you're absolutely obsessively committed to preserving the environment, and you love pussycats and all these other things. That's really what you've got to demonstrate all the time. And I also thought it was very interesting, and I, you know, as a sociologist, was that nobody really commented. One of the companies, Exxon. That's called a Freudian slip where I come from. Had this document, and it was a 48-page document on the impact of risk. Now, of the 48 pages, 41 pages were devoted to essentially public relations accomplishment. It was about how to write press releases. And in fact, they gave you 8 different varieties of press releases you could write. They were all templates, you know, sort of in case there's a spillage. And only 7.5 pages of the document dealt with anything that's remotely technical. That's to do with anything that you would call risk management. And I thought that was interesting. And I think the reason why that was interesting is because you could argue that this company is obsessed with public relations. But of course, if we live in a world where managing risk becomes so important, you have to perform the role that's assigned to you, it becomes increasingly evident that you will adopt a focus on reputational risk and about defending your reputation. And that becomes more important, in a sense, than anything else. And I think that kind of development it has got to be seen in that kind of context. Anyways, what I argue is that once you begin to have a situation where companies and institutions are forced to organize around the principle of risk management, they change their very character. And isn't just for the large companies. For example, we did a bit of research on British parents and their relationship to children. And we have, in England, this very stupid idea, the worst example of worst-case thinking, where every adult that comes anywhere near a child has got to be police-registered. So, for example, if I drive my son to his soccer match, that's fine. I don't have to be registered with the police because I'm the father. But if my son's friend travels to the football game with us every single weekend, you're not going to be police arrested with the CRB, with a special bureau, right, where you register yourself that you're a safe enough person. And when we were doing interviews with parents, I thought there'd be a huge riot against this. Everybody would say, this is a complete waste of time. Well, virtually every parent that we interviewed said, it was fine. You know, if one child, if only one child is protected from a pedophile, it's worth 7.5 million adults in England being registered with the police. And when we were interviewing parents, we met parents who came to me and said, you know, Frank, you know, if my child has got a sleepover with another child and sleeps at their parents' house, I want to make sure that those other parents are also CRB checked. This is entirely, it's not the law, this is entirely their own reaction, where they're performing, you know, sort of risk. It's their way of demonstrating their sense of responsibility. And basically, you know, what I think is happening here is that once you begin to go in this particular direction, then your whole way of life becomes more and more rule-bound. You're dominated by rules and procedures. And increasingly what's important is not what you do, but what you seem to be doing. And that's what the oil companies are doing. The oil companies are no different than the parents are, except the devastating consequences. What also happens is that as we become more and more rule-bound, and as procedures kick in, and as process dominates your organization, informal relations between people begin to break down, local knowledge becomes relatively unimportant, and as a result of that, you stick to the rules, because your own individual reputation is also at risk in such circumstances. And we know, for example, that when the oil spillage began with BP, there were at least two people who alerted the authorities that this was occurring, but because they were in the wrong job at the wrong time, nobody listened to them. They were told, that's not part of your job description. It's not up to you to tell us about this. We need to make sure the right guy tells us when to evacuate. And this was before the explosion occurred. So what I'm arguing is that essentially, the performance of risk isn't just simply stupid, and isn't just simply a waste of time, but what it also does is it has the potential of making our life far less secure. We do that with children in England, because my argument is if you basically have 7.5 million adults on a police register, and if you assume every adult is a pedophile, that's the default position, you're not going to be able to know where the real threats are. You're going to be desensitized about anticipating those kinds of problems. And similarly, in large organizations like oil companies, if you have this public relations-oriented approach where your reputational risk is more important than the real technical issues, health and safety issues that you're confronted with, instead of making the oil business safe, you actually compromise it. And I think that's the lesson that I've learned from this. And I blame not just the petrol companies, but I blame the culture that incites people to perform risk rather than to manage it. Thank you.
We have about 20 minutes for questions.
So, question for both Burns. So we have you had that data on survey responses after terrorist events, accidents, etc. Do you know, has anyone gone to any of the travel agencies or the airlines to see, you know, presumably there's an app you can calculate the expected number of tickets that are going to be purchased in a given day and know how that decreases the after 9/11, after different events. Does anyone have that data? Have you used that data? Have you tried to get that data?
Yes and no. After 9/11, some of my colleagues had created the Center for Risk Economic Analysis of Terrorism Events did a study on the impact of the airline industry. And within 5 months following 9/11 or thereabouts, it was about a 30, once you control for econometrically what would have happened to the airline industry anyway, because they were in a downturn just before 9/11. Once you control for that, it was a 30% hit to ridership. And so, and then after that, it was still a residual effect of about 6 or 7% out 2 or 3 years. So we do have that kind of behavioral data. Also after the bombings here in London, in July 2005, colleagues looked at ridership on the tube, and it right within a day, it measurably dropped, even though it's, correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding from the paper is that all but, I think, two stations or something were still operating. In other words, the city the system-wide was operated. And it was over, from July to about December, there was about 47 million less riders. And principally on the weekends, where people had the discretion not to go to their jobs. And then it eventually came back, but there's some inertia there. And it wasn't like the substitutes in the subway system was attractive. It's my understanding there's a congestion tax for riding from far, cabs and metro are expensive, and riding your bikes was not that attractive after a while. And so we have that. We did try to get, right after the Christmas Day, one colleague that I'm working with, her husband is a pilot for American Airlines. We've made attempts to get the data on that. So far, been unsuccessful. But it may happen.
I'm coming from this business about crowds and so forth. It seemed to me that the presentation mixed up several different sorts of crowds, which are very different. You have a crowd where a disaster has happened, right? A fire has broken out or whatever it may be, where you're asking people to save themselves and to save others. You also have crowds where they're just too big, right? And something collapses or whatever, and then lots of people get crushed, or lots of young girls end up screaming and fainting at the front and so forth. You have a different sort of problem in preventing damage to people. And then you have the sort of political process which you started with, which was the Paris Commune, or you can go further back to the London mob, which if you read the political history of the Tudors or whatever, the Tudors spent most of their time trying to deal with the London mob, which basically meant public opinion as to whether or not their proposed marriage or whatever was all right, because if the people of London didn't like it, they turned up and rioted, right? Because they didn't have any power per se. That was where they expressed their power. So are they not very different sorts of crowds? Because the way in which they're going to behave, the way in which they're on the streets in the first place, is completely different.
Yes, there are differences in crowds, and if I had more time to tease out, I'd go into more detail. But there is actually a lot more commonality in the behaviour than one might expect, even that we expected. The models we initially derived from crowd conflict, and then we developed it to look at behaviour in mass emergencies, and our initial theory was that there would be some situations where mass panic might occur because of the lack of a common identity that, say, a political crowd might have. That was our initial hypothesis. We actually found that not to be supported by the evidence, that the emergency itself can create a common identity that is briefly, perhaps potentially as strong as a political crowd's common identity, because the common identity is survival. So the more we looked, actually, the less differences and the more commonality we found. But yeah, there are slight nuances. I mean, in mass emergencies, it's almost unheard of for the crowd to attack the police and the emergency services, because why should they? Whereas in disorder and riots, they would, but then there's still a selection, which explains why firefighters and ambulance crews are very rarely attacked in riots, whereas police might come under very sustained and very intensive attack. So yeah, actually less differences than we expected.
No. I was interested in the commonalities between Scott's talk and Chris's talk. I mean, I'm also dealing with very different kinds of situations, but for example, the question you gave us that police attempting measures of crowd control actually only led to solidarity amongst the crowd. It reminds me slightly of Scott's evidence that offering inducements to change your sacred values again only leads to greater solidarity amongst the people who you're trying to control. But equally, just as Scott finds that offering to make concessions at the level of sacred values is actually a way of changing people's position, I wonder if, in some sense, one could say that the way the police should be dealing with crowds is to make concessions at that sort of level, not, in other words, to treat people, from a position of power, but to treat them as equals and to give them respect. I wanted Scott to comment on how what he heard from you.
Well, there's very interesting studies by a guy named Charles Strozer, who's a psychoanalyst. And what he found is that the people spontaneously organized themselves on the stairwells coming down in 9/11. And the police, the firemen especially, recognize this spontaneous organization and rather than direct them, work with them. And in fact, the flow down the stairways beat all rational model predictions of how fast they could evacuate. Mm-hmm. Then there wasn't really any command and control. So it was extremely efficient.
So you talked about, you took a kind of negative view as to all efforts to improve the trust for regulators, at least as far as I can tell. So first I had a question about your problem with transparency.
You sort of mentioned that it was the problem seems to be that it disempowers opponents, and you get interested parties that just have an agenda and are trying to use the information to their advantage. It doesn't represent everyone's view. But it seems to me that isn't the purpose of transparency to allow enemies to see what's wrong, and if they can't find that anything's wrong, they can't find anything credible, then it sort of deflates and diffuses their argument. Is that not useful? And also, what would you recommend as a, given the limitations of everything you presented, what would be a positive recommendation for improving the trust from regulation?
So two great questions. On the first one, basically, I'm not saying we should just all transparency is garbage. I'm not saying that, it's very clear. I'm saying basically we should have more forms of managed transparency. I think basically putting everything out on the internet, for example, will lead to public confusion. And in my view, we should just evaluate these type of efforts before they go in public domain. And I mentioned, for example, with regard to the FDA, I don't know if you've seen this, but basically just last month, the task force, the FDA, Josh Sharpstein, put out a 63-page document basically calling for more public disclosure and having 22 proposals. There is not one scientific reference supporting that. It's based on 1,500 basically commentaries from publics and special interest groups. That, for me, worries me. I want to ensure that transparency will work and evaluated properly and scientifically, with the leading people, leading psychologists and leading sociologists and so on and so forth around the world. That's what I'm saying. It is putting forward a warning flag. I'm not saying we should rubbish transparency because, to be honest with you, the cat is out of the bag, right? We can't go back and say no more transparency. That would not work at all. We got to see work have some kind of smart transparency, science-based transparency. And that kind of answers your second question, right, too, is that if we have smart science-based transparency, we can rebuild trust. In addition to that, I think basically that policymakers, regulators, industry should be much more honest. I'm sort of appalled, for example, about the BP example here, is that BP was not really honest with us. They say basically, first of all, 1,000 barrels a day. Oh, it's 5,000 barrels a day. Oh, it's 50. It's 20. They should have said, we don't know. We have no idea how many barrels are leaking out of the ground. That's what really happen every day, folks. And we have the best available scientists working on it, and when they have an answer to it, then basically we call it. That's a much more honest answer. And what's shocking to me, this day and age, 21st century, is that so many industry regulators still get it wrong. No, I've gone for ages. Volcano example is also an example of bad communication, especially with the communication way.
There's a Dana Boyd, who's at this workshop last year, has a paper on transparency. It's on our website. She talked about the danger of transparency without context. So if she was here, she talked about that.
I'll
give you a little reference. Stuart's next.
So back to Phil Burns again, I want to keep him busy. So I take issue with the cockpit door as an example of something where rational people should think this is safety and not security barrier. Because when I fly, I see it open quite frequently so that pilots can use the bathroom. It's very often open before the plane takes off. And it seems quite easy to get in there if you're the bad guys. But because the good guys are going to be sloppy, because incidents where people take over planes are extremely rare. But if the bad guys get in there, which they like to do if they want to knock down a building, they're not going to really exit to leave the bathroom or believe that it's probably safe this time to go out for that purpose. And so you're creating a very secure environment for them once they've taken over the plane. So I actually feel lots less safe because that cockpit door is now locked. And I would side with that supposedly irrational group that says this is security theater and it may even be making them less safe.
It is a minority view.
Yeah.
I stand corrected. You made a persuasive argument for me. I took that as a benchmark. It was not a question that Bruce suggested we do. And but your point is well taken. I've made the same observation. You know, it illustrates something that we often, and I've been guilty of this, have discounted the public's ability to assess risk. And so, and I gave an illustration here where the public, in the beginning, right after Christmas, when I made presentations, people in the crowd would say, there's an example where the public is grossly exaggerated the probability of a terrorist event, but we saw one happen, another attempt, in the next few months. And I think you're right. That's a good point.
I have three more questions in the queue.
First of all, Chris, following the original question, how does curious crowd, your crowd behavior in evacuation square with events such as the Heysel Stadium tragedy? You may remember 1985 Champions League final, four people dead and 600 injured when some supporter from the opposite team went past the fence, went closer to the supporter of the other team, who panicked, started pushing against each other and many people died.
Well, with specific reference to the Heysel disaster, I think there's a very good chapter on a book called Football in Its Place by David Cantor. I think that's the reference. Basically, it argues in there that the overriding factor in that was a very poor choice of stadium. It was a second division stadium. It was not suited for European Cup final at all. And the reason so many tragic disasters was the wall actually collapsed because it was so poorly built. Hooliganism was a factor, but from that reference I'm thinking of a minor one, and a much more contributory one was very, very poor stadium design. I mean, it's something that came out of the Hillsborough disaster, which has now been comprehensively shown to be not related to hooliganism at all. It's actually a miracle that Hillsborough hadn't happened many times before because of the very poor design of football stadia in Britain and in Europe, which thankfully has now changed since the Hillsborough disaster and the Taylor report into it. So even when hooliganism happens, I would dispute whether or not that's sort of the contributory factor towards mass deaths in those situations.
So this is a question for, I guess, both Ragnar and Bill, or maybe one or other. But in the context of the exaggeration of fear and the dangers of transparency, I'm just wondering whether either of you have ever know of any studies that have looked at whether the extent to which reactions to scary things in the press have actually been demonstrably worse than the scary things that people were reacting to. There was the only case I know of with this was back when the mad cow disease scare hit in the UK in the spring of 94, and that summer there was a rise above the baseline in deaths from salmonella, which was greater than the total number of deaths ever attributed to the Vivarium coxsackievicum disease. And there was even documented cases of trichinosis in the UK, which hadn't been documented in the UK for 30 years. And these were attributed to the switching of barbecuing beef to barbecuing chicken and pork in the summer. And I'm just wondering, have there been much study?
One obvious example is the Israelis' reaction to the Scud attacks in the first Gulf War, where a lot more people died from coronary disease, heart attacks,
than
from
the actual.
From the actual stone.
But I just was wondering if has anybody looked at the wider picture of to what extent do people kill themselves over worry?
Well, a couple of examples. One was mentioned this morning with regard to the third generation pill scare we had in the UK back in the 90s, where basically a massive media amplification said basically that a doubling of the risk of ovarian cancer in women. And actual fact, yes, it was a doubling, it was only from 1 in 1 million to 2 in 1 million. And what happened with that was then is that women started to stop taking the pill, they still were sexually active. And we had basically unwanted pregnancies, we had unwanted children, and we also had many abortions. And what happened is that the abortion levels have still not come back to prior to that scale. That's one example. If Bill Lees's work from Canada is looking, for example, at consumption of salmon, what happened after January 2004 article in Science showing basically that pregnant women should need salmon more than once a month, he had a fall in salmon consumption by more than 40% over a 1 year period. And of course, their benefits outweigh the risks in eating salmon because they're omega 3s and stuff. Can you get references after this?
Bill?
Two comments. So, one example might be that the media's reporting of the initial worries about swine flu, H1N1, where, think about this for a minute, there were first reports of a few people dying in Mexico, right? And so the media began to report this, the people died. What they didn't get right, and partly they didn't have good information, but they jumped the gun to reporting, they failed to really get the denial. They got the numerator right, that's easy to count, and people died. What they didn't get right was the denial of how many people was really exposed, and as a result, how lethal this virus appeared to be in the beginning was much exaggerated, to the point where when we had the first case in the United States, I think a baby died, maybe, made a big deal of. And the media failed to remind people that, yes, it's tragic that this one person died, but that if over 30,000 people die from just every year, regular flu. And so there's one example there. To come to your transparency issue, I think you gave a great example of recognition that public officials don't know how to say, I don't know. They really don't. And if you look at the head of Homeland Security's response that in two occasions, one to the Christmas Day bombing, where she said the system worked, I mean, she should have kind of stood back and said, oh, let's wait and see what really is going on here. And then right after in the Times Square, they jumped the gun that who the culprit might be, which they were entertained by video clips in Times Square. I mean, it's we need to in terms of risk communication, in this business of transparency, we really do need to learn and give permission to our public officials to say, we don't know yet. Give us some time. And there seems to be a real rush to get closure, even if it's wrong, to get closure on an issue.
I mean, the chief medical officer in the UK said, a question of if of when we have 75,000 people dead in the UK because of Bush. No?
Gene?
Sorry.
Oh, that's okay. Everybody's using this birth control example. Is abortion really that dangerous? Or are we just upset that is it our own sacred values?
It's not the abortion, but the fact that what happened was that. Pregnancy is actually is more risky than taking the contraceptive out. Okay. That was the problem.
So it's genuinely a risk issue and not our own.
As it happens, factually, the rates of abortion are higher than at the time, mainly because of immigration patterns and all the rest of that. But what is interesting was at the time, all the stats show that the consequence of the decision was that there were much larger presentations for related illnesses related to pregnancy and various infections and all the rest of that. So this is one of and the other thing that was very interesting is that every European country reacted differently. And in some societies like Belgium, where there was a much more robust culture, there was literally no contraception or Hong Kong. But in all the societies which were Protestant and precautionary, the pill panic had a pretty devastating effect.
Scott and then Ross and then go on.
Okay, so there was this paper written in the 1920s called The Jerk Effect. The Jerk Effect, I think it was the Ford Motor Company that commissioned it. And it was about the first time you run over potholes and you go crazy and you sort of panic. And by the second, third time, it dramatically decreases. So based on that, there were studies done of the bombing of Barcelona, first mustard gas attacks during the war, and the bombing of during the Blitz here in London, and found the same jerk effect. That is, people actually did panic on the first instance, but by the second instance, there was almost complete control by the population. Now, if the media intervenes, they can affect which way it will go. So if the media says nothing, where it says calm down, then the sort of natural instinct of the crowd after the first instance will follow that. But if the media incites it, then they very well incite fear. And our media is very peculiar and very recent. It's only since video editing and competition in the 24-hour news cycle that this ability to evoke fear, by the way, what officials do is almost irrelevant now. It's what the media highlights. And this is being played in, by the way. The terrorists, if the Mumbai attack, the handler, the Mumbai bombers, basically said, wait till the media comes. When the media came, there was a Skype for the guys in the Mumbai hotel saying, the media is here, now blow up people and die.
Ross.
Yes, this is an interesting point. We've had discussions at previous shows of the extent to which the media are in some sense responsible. I'm interested in your talk, Scott. You were talking about how the reactions seem to be the same in Israel and in the Arab lands, and that's perhaps a small example of where you have got, on the one hand, a democratic country with the media driven by Western values of novelty and so on and so forth, whereas in the Arab world you have autocratic regimes with heavily controlled media. In your experience, does this actually make any difference to anything?
Yeah, it does. I mean, you have to, in Israel, you have to get the population to drive the people. In Arab countries, you've got to get the leaders to drive the population.
As much as I actually hate to cut this short, we're a little over time, so we'll see you all at dinner. So 6 to 6:30 if you say in Robinson, we'll walk together. 7 o'clock at college, drinks, and then sit down here at 7:30. So that's the schedule.
I think I did a reference to the White House guys.